Okay, good morning. You're listening to WHCL 88.7 FM. My name's Pete Bianco. This show is titled The Ringer, and my guest today is Julia Ross. Julia is an author. Julia, thank you for joining me this morning.
Well, I'm delighted to be with you.
Specifically, I have a curiosity about alcoholism, and how do genetics relate to nutritional requirements when it comes to alcoholism?
Well, if you mean how to avoid alcoholism, people who tend to become alcoholics quite often have a genetic predisposition that's perfectly obvious, usually, you know, going back through the family lines. Generally, it's about 75% genetic, and 25% other possible factors. But the genetics is a major issue in all addictions, actually, all alcohol and drug addictions. So if you're in the position of thinking about, you know, knowing that your children, for example, are in line for developing alcoholism, the main thing you want to know is that they can never eat less than three meals a day, frequently need snacks, and that protein is particularly required, because the nutrients that the brain needs to regulate appetite and mood that are typically dysregulated in someone with the alcoholic genes, all of those neurotransmitters are made out of protein. And so I'm talking about animal protein, so really thinking in terms of a traditional diet, we have more and more alcoholism and other addictions, you know, in this culture, because we've, since the 70s, not been eating traditional foods, and fewer and fewer as time goes on. So it's a real struggle and a challenge to feed any children well now, let alone special needs children like the children, you know, from families where there's alcoholism. Plenty of protein, but other, you know, high-quality foods, so a nutrient-dense and diet. Alcoholism tends to, used to be combined in terms of diagnosis with hypoglycemia and diabetes, because there's such a common feature of blood sugar dysregulation, you know, in among all three. And one of the reasons that people can become so desperate for alcohol is that they have a real, often unknown, difficulty regulating their blood sugar. So their blood sugar can crash suddenly, and alcohol is one of the fastest substances on earth in terms of bringing it up again. And so to watch blood sugar regulation, to feed the kids and adults eat often enough to offset that is very important. And for somebody who's trying to recover from alcoholism, the same thing is true. One of the problems with eating well in recovery is that one of the nutrients that gets so depleted, among many others, by the regular intake of alcohol is zinc, which regulates the taste buds. And a lot of people who drink heavily, you know, just lose their interest in food. It just doesn't taste good anymore.
Wow.
And at that point, the progression of the disease gets, you know, a lot more rapid. There was a marvelous a nutrition researcher, Daphne Roe, R-O-E, who wrote a book on alcoholism and nutrition, and pointed this out in the, late 70s, early 80s. A very important researcher. I wish her work had been, retained, because most recovery efforts pay absolutely no attention to diet. In fact, you know, they encourage people to substitute nutrient void, you know, high calorie, highly addictive, high sugar, high starch foods for the drugs and alcohol that they're trying to leave behind, which typically sets up a terrible inevitable relapse pattern.
Now, why do you think it is that more recovery programs don't focus on nutrition in the proper way? Is it that they're unaware of that, or there's some other force that's...
Well, there are two things. You know, I think that the main reason in my experience, you know, and I've been in the addiction treatment field since the middle 70s, is that most of the people who are running these programs have managed to stay sober themselves using the 12-step programs, lots of caffeine, lots of tobacco, and lots of junk food, and they figure that's the best anybody can hope for. And what they, and they're very, you know, they're highly addicted to these substitute substances, and it's a big challenge for them personally to propose that people in recovery eat well, and so that they don't, you know, they're just not open to it personally, and that translates into professionally. Some of the higher-end programs are including very good quality food, and that's a great advance. I mean, the movie stars don't go to programs that don't have a special chef and so forth. You know, so some programs are different, but most of the programs include tremendous amounts of junk food. And then there's a third factor, which is that... if they didn't serve this kind of food, their clientele would probably leave sooner, because they're not—they wouldn't be providing enough support to really relieve the cravings for substances, which is, you know, what drives addiction. So let's say we have an alcoholism goes into a treatment program and gets three good meals a day and decaf coffee. But the cravings for the alcohol are undiminished and just unrelenting. And so the person with the best will in the world who likes the counseling is willing to do the 12 steps and sees value in them and thinks that a good diet is a good idea may still be unable to stay sober, and particularly when they leave. Because all they can think about is to go back to consuming either alcohol or, you know, sugar and so forth. And that's why we've developed techniques beyond diet. So diet is fundamental. That's got to change, and that's got to be supportive. And a recovery diet is very dense in nutrients. It's frequent in nutrients, and it's individualized to see what does this person need, what do they like, how can we, you know, bring that together for them. But most people cannot maintain a healthy diet, even though they want to and they understand intellectually how important that might be, because of their cravings. So that's where the nutrients come in, and that's really the fundamental premise of my books, The Diet Cure and The Mood Cure. The Diet Cure is about food addiction, and the Mood Cure is about, it has a chapter on alcohol and drug addiction, and is all about the mood chemistry of the brain, the mood and appetite chemistry of the brain, and how we can reprogram it quickly using brain-targeted nutrient supplements. So we combine an improved diet with these supplements that go to work within minutes to turn off the cravings, turn on our optimal mood and sense of well-being, so that people don't feel that desperate need for some relief, some relief of negative moods, negative thinking, and relief from the cravings. So we have this technology that's very well developed. It was introduced in the 1980s. I've been using it in my clinics since 1986. I've rarely seen anyone who did not respond to it. They exist. There are other problems in some people, but the vast majority of recovering people, whether they're alcohol and drug addicts or food addicts, respond beautifully. We actually do trials using these supplements right in the office when they come into our clinic, our outpatient clinic, and they notice the benefits within 10 minutes at the most, which makes it very easy for them to comply and, you know, be willing to take supplements several times a day for a year. So the benefits are immediate, but only if you keep taking them. But over time, the brain chemistry responds, it normalizes, it optimizes, even in these genetically predisposed people. We get a permanent correction of the appetite and mood chemistry of the brain, and that's the protection that they need for the future. And, you know, if we ever can get anybody to do research on it, it may protect their offspring as well, because they may be passing on improved genetic transmission. But, you know, that's, who knows about that. But what we do know is, for their own lifetime, they have a very secure remedy for the addictive cravings that, you know, lead them into such terrible trouble.
I've been doing a lot of interviews recently with dentists and trying to understand dental health, and it seems that there's a lot of overlap between what you're talking about and dental health. I don't know if you know the dentist Melvin Page.
I don't.
Okay, he was popular in the 1950s, and he was saying that sugar disturbs your calcium-phosphorus balance more than any other single factor. So it's raising your calcium and lowering your phosphorus. So he was saying, proposing that people who were alcoholics, they were their blood sugar was out of balance, and they were craving for it to be back into balance. And also zinc, when you were talking about zinc, some of the people talking about dental health are saying that we need proper amounts of zinc, and that things that antagonize our zinc are phytates that are in certain grains and beans. And I don't know if that's something that you touch on at all.
Yes.
Okay. Would you like to speak about that and how that affects people's zinc levels?
Well, one of the other common genetic problems these days is intolerance to certain grains, which causes people to overeat wheat in particular, and all grains and legumes contain digestion inhibitors called phytates, and they. So zinc is one of the fatalities, one of the suppressed nutrients in diets that contain so much grain. And legumes, frankly, aren't usually that much of a problem because most people don't overeat them. But most people are living on an exclusively grain-based diet.
And so even when if it's a white flour, it still contains the phytates, even?
And of course it contains enormous increasing amounts of gluten, which actually damages the whole digestive tract, and the tip of the digestive tract, the villi that line the digestive tract, the tips of those villi is the area of the digestive process that absorbs minerals like zinc.
Oh, wow.
It's the first thing to be worn off by gluten-containing grain. So there are a lot of different problems with the phytate, not just the phytates, but with other aspects of grain. And the truth is that we're an ancient system. The human body is an ancient system, and there were no grains for, you know, most of our lives on the planet, you know, when we look back. Grains are a novelty. They're a new invention, relatively speaking. And there's some interesting research on the mummies of Egypt. And when they've been, and there are hundreds of thousands of them, it wasn't just the aristocracy and the monarchs and so forth who were embalmed that way, but regular ordinary people often were, and so we have these sort of preserved cadavers, well-preserved cadavers, and we see that their health was very bad. They were overweight. Their teeth were ground down to the gums. They had atherosclerosis. They were living, here they were in the most fertile area of the world, but they had discovered wheat and barley, these gluten-containing grains, which they couldn't digest, but that's all they ate. They were growing grain and spices, basically. They grew garlic and onions and things that they ate with the grain, but it was a tremendous business opportunity because grains keep well, and it was the first food that could ever be used, as a form of currency.
Well,
let's not get off too far off track here.
I just wanted to ask you about the coffee. You had mentioned people switching to drinking a lot of coffee as a form of coping. And I was wondering, does the coffee have an effect on sugar metabolism, or is that a different effect that it's fulfilling?
Well, it is. It's a real problem in alcoholism, and with many people generally, maybe most people, adults these days, because they're using caffeine instead of eating. So when you drink coffee in the morning, it suppresses appetite. That's one of the things it's supposed to do. It's a stimulant. They all suppress appetite. So that means that the majority of Americans aren't eating breakfast, and for an alcoholic, that's absolutely fatal because you haven't eaten since hopefully the night before. That's a long, long time, and then you don't eat breakfast either. And so you're building, you're just eroding your blood sugar stability from the time you have that first cup of coffee, and that's my primary objection to it. There are other problems with coffee, but... it's, highly acidic, it causes fibrocysts, it's a drug, and a very, very lucrative one, but it's not a health product. So for alcoholics in particular, caffeine needs to be avoided assiduously. And again, this is a daunting proposal for most people because, they can't function without their coffee, but I love to tell the story of the worst coffee addict we ever had, which is a woman who actually drank pots of it all day, but she started in the morning, and when we told her that she wouldn't be doing that on the program, she became enraged and, said, "I want to stop eating sugar. I didn't say anything about the coffee, and in fact, I can't function at all if I don't have coffee." And so I was brought in, and I made a deal with her. And I said, "You can have your coffee if you put these naturally brain-stimulating, in a very positive way. Our brain is supposed to be making its own healthful version of caffeine all the time, especially in the morning. And these nutrients encourage the brain to make more of that natural stimulant in the morning, which doesn't interfere with appetite." So he said, you wake up in the morning, you have the bottle of these supplements next to you, on your bedside table, these amino acids, called tyrosine, by the way, and, take at least two, and if you still want coffee when you wake up, have it, when you get up, if you can't function, and then you have to promise to call us in the afternoon. So in the afternoon, we got the phone call, and she said, my alarm went off, I took the two tyrosine, I pressed the snooze alarm, and when it rang again, this is a 5 snooze alarm person, said when it rang again, which would be the second alarm, I was ready to get up. And I made it through all day with no coffee. And that is typical. This is, so there are easy ways to get off of coffee and still have good energy, have better energy, actually, without the crashes, because caffeine not only raises blood sugar temporarily, very temporarily, but then supplies the crash, and there's no food digesting at the time, so the whole system goes down. And, of course, what does somebody do when they start having a crash after caffeine? They have more caffeine, and the crash goes on all day long, which up and down, which is just a disaster for someone with alcoholic sensitive blood sugar dysregulated alcoholics.
Now, is the tyrosine helping the brain to produce a cortisol in the morning?
No. It produces a neurotransmitter called norepinephrine, which is our natural caffeine. It creates alertness and extroversion and mental energy.
Is that the same as adrenaline, norepinephrine?
No.
Okay.
Actually, adrenaline is a byproduct of norepinephrine. So the body makes norepinephrine. Another name for norepinephrine is noradrenaline. And out of the noradrenaline, some part of it is converted into adrenaline. So you get both from tyrosine, and the brain can decide how much, the brain and the adrenals can decide how much of each is required.
So are you supplementing people with mostly amino acids or minerals?
We supplement them with everything. We give them a vitamin and mineral bath and usually various fatty acids depending on what they seem to need, but the most targeted nutrients that we use at high dose individualized basis are the amino acids. So they work, they can work best along with this bath of vitamins and minerals that people are taking three times a day with their meals, because although without the amino acids, all the vitamins and minerals in the world can't restore a normal brain and eliminate cravings and mood swings, but if you combine them, the vitamins and minerals, with the amino acids in concentration, then you get this beautiful conversion. All the nutrients are there. And of course, because the combination of vitamins and minerals with the concentrated amino acids turns off the cravings for the junk food as well as for the alcohol or drugs, then you have this lovely diet that then comes in to support this whole restructuring of the brain and body and restoration of the function.
Is there a specific diet that you're recommending? I know that you're saying that they need to be eating frequently and eating good amounts of protein.
Well, I pretty much identify it in both the mood cure and the diet cure. There are whole sections about what kind of diet is recommended, what seems to work best, why saturated fats, for example, are so helpful in recovery. Partly because they're so helpful in stabilizing blood sugar.
Have you found any information that shows the unsaturated fats to be polyunsaturated to be harmful?
Oh, it's endless.
Okay.
Yeah. We obviously know the polyunsaturated hydrogenated fats are deadly. They're the real cause of primary cause of heart disease. And there was a big when all the research came out in the 90s, identifying the hydrogenated polyunsaturated fats and oils as the real culprits in heart disease. Those same studies exonerated saturated fats, made it clear that there was no problem; they did not cause heart disease. So we've had this information, but for a while people were aware of it, and now peanut butter is full of hydrogenated fats. It's as if that research never existed. And, restaurant food is full of it, loaded with it, because they don't have to identify what's in their food. And most people are eating out most of the time. So it's...
And even beyond the hydrogenated fats, there are also the polyunsaturated fats go rancid very easily.
Well, they go rancid very easily, and they're full of a particular type of fat, the omega-6 fats, which completely destroys the ideal balance of the omega-3 fats, which are supposed to be, they're both supposed to be consumed in small amounts in a balanced way, and we're eating just loads of these fragile polyunsaturated oils now. and very little fish, and so we have thrown our balance of these, especially in the brain, of these critical fats off. So we need to go back again to the traditional diet, which generated ideal weights, low addiction rates, good health, very little heart disease, and that diet is what I'm advocating. Is I'm just saying, go back 50 years or more, go back as far as possible, and eat the traditional diet if you know your own genetic predilections. You know, if you know what kind of diet your ancestors ate, eat it. And if you don't, because you know we're such a hodgepodge genetically in this country, a lot of us have no idea who our ancestors were or what they ate, or there are so many of them we don't know which diet to choose. Then we can get, very simply, eat plenty of protein. So by that I mean the equivalent of 3 eggs for breakfast. A chicken breast, a steak, a fish fillet. I'm not talking about a gargantuan steak. A little filet mignon will do. a good quality hamburger patty. And then plenty of vegetables and some fruit, particularly as with snacks, with a few nuts and seeds. And you got it.
Mm-hmm. So what you're talking about sounds pretty comparable to Sally Fallon's work with nursing.
Well, the Weston A. Price work, really. Right. You know, she's a spokesperson for Weston A. Price, and her Weston A. Price Foundation is priceless, frankly, in the information that it's disseminating.
Uh-huh.
And tremendously popular. You know, thank God there's really a huge movement to restore traditional foods in order to restore traditional health.
Uh-huh. I believe that Melvin Page was a contemporary of Weston Price. And so
heroes.
I've got one more question for you that relates to that, and I just was wondering with your work if this sounds correct to you. He had a hypothesis back in the 50s that alcohol...
Who?
Melvin Page, the dentist.
Well, go ahead. Did alcohol what?
Alcoholics may be deficient in posterior pituitary secretion, and as a result have too little calcium and too much phosphorus in the blood. This condition produces a state of nervous irritation, which is relieved by alcohol, which raises the calcium and lowers the phosphorus at the same time.
Low calcium and high phosphorus? Or do you mean the reverse?
Let's see. He's saying it's relieved by alcohol because alcohol raises calcium.
What's relieved?
Their cravings.
But is he saying they're relieved because you were saying earlier that sugar raises calcium and lowers phosphorus? Is he saying the same thing about alcohol?
Yes, it raises calcium and lowers phosphorus.
Well, we do see a lot of people with excessively high calcium, and there's been a lot of furor about it actually recently because there's been so much supplementation with calcium when at the same time we're eating high sugar and in the case of alcoholics high alcohol diets, and that's really not what you want to do. There's a high correlation of course with heart disease and alcoholism and sugar consumption, and the high calcium is certainly a factor in that, and low magnesium typically, so that the heart is contracting, and its ability to then relax and expand is not in balance. It's not keeping up with the calcium-driven contraction.
Well, is that similar to how people get muscle cramps at night in their legs?
Yeah, quite often magnesium deficiency is a cause of muscle cramps, but not always. I mean, a lot of people have restless leg syndrome, where they have cramping as part of the whole syndrome, and that's more complicated. But let's get back to alcoholism and how we cure it, because I can tell that you're too knowledgeable about details, and my guess is that your listeners are not as knowledgeable as you are, and rather than deal with the possible fine points, let's get to the big issues, which are how do you stop alcoholism?
Yes.
And most people don't want to talk about that because, frankly, on some level they know that the conventional treatment just it doesn't work. And so what's to talk about? We're going to have a revolving door of relapse, and people are going to be progressively in progressively more despair. Because nothing that they do seems to be helping, even though they believe in it and want it so badly. And their family members and employers, are more and more contemptuous, and it's a nightmare for everyone involved. So it deserves new remedies that actually work. And amino acid therapy is tremendously successful. It's been evidencing success since the 1980s when it was first presented to us by a neuroscientist, Kenneth Blum, who did clinical trials that were fascinating and exciting. And when we applied them starting in 1986, we started to see our alcoholics and other addicts have tremendous response. And it really needs to be in the basic arsenal. First aid for alcoholism has got to be nutrients galore, vitamins and minerals, and then these brain-targeted amino acid supplements to turn the lights back on so that life is worth living without alcohol. That's really the critical goal, to make life worth living. They are not alcoholics because they decided it would be fun to be an alcoholic. They are alcoholics because only on alcohol do they have any fun, even if it's only for 5 minutes. And so they're struggling with a neurotransmitter deficiency disease that with a genetic component, it's stubborn. And it's a miracle, really, that these simple nutrients that are not expensive, that are easy to administer and easy to track in terms of their effectiveness, in other words, dosing. You start with the lowest dose. If you don't feel any relief, you go into the second highest dose. And the effects are literally available within 5 or 10 minutes.
And how many amino acids are used in this therapy?
It depends on the person. So the real key to my books on how to use amino acid therapy, and there are a couple of other books out there that are wonderful on this subject. Charles Gant, an MD from Syracuse, who's a brilliant physician and pioneer in the use of amino acids and other nutrients with alcoholics, has written a marvelous book called The End, or End Addiction Now. And another clinician in Minneapolis who's been running nutritionally based recovery programs for over 20 years, Joan Matthews Larson, has written a fabulous book that just can't stop selling called 7 Weeks to Sobriety. Probably the single best book ever written on alcoholism.
Wow.
But my books are perhaps slightly clearer in their self-assessment questionnaire so that you can identify very quickly what amino acids you particularly need. And so that, I would say, is one of their advantages. But I think any alcoholic or anybody who's concerned about an alcoholic should have all three books, my books and the Gant and Matthews Larson books.
Now, is this something that the person can do by themselves or with the help of a friend using the books, or do they need to be...
Well, some people can, and some people need to go inpatient because they're just too far along or they don't have the supportive system around them to help them do it, or they're looking at a life-threatening detox. You know, alcoholism is one of the few addictions that can actually be cause, acute death. The only one other than the benzodiazepines that can cause seizure and death. So some people's alcoholism, has progressed to the degree that they really do need to have either an inpatient or outpatient detox with medication along with the supplements. But the first step for anyone would be to try it themselves, along with, you know, getting whatever other support they possibly can, you know, counseling, 12-step programs, everything, because this is a life-destroying disease, and we need to do everything possible and combine Bill Wilson was a great advocate of nutritional therapy later in his life when he discovered it, and it eliminated his own terrible depression, which lasted long into recovery. So he was always talking about the biopsychosocial, the physical, emotional, and spiritual aspects of addiction. And at that time, they didn't know very much about the physical. We know a lot more about it now. We know how the brain chemistry works in addiction to alcohol, and how the neurotransmitters really control our cravings and our moods, so that we can really heal that brain chemistry that's out of control. He would have loved the amino acid therapy. And I'm sorry that it wasn't discovered until after he died, because he would have made sure to promote it.
For people who are in an area that has someone who would be working like this, how do you find out where there are people that are working with addiction that have the nutritional component in their work? Is there
they would Google, you know, I'm assuming you're talking about looking for inpatient programs.
Yes.
There are some inpatient programs in various parts of the country that work with amino acid therapy. Not as many as there should be, but they're easy to find, you know, if you Google alcoholism recovery or, you know, drug addiction recovery, whatever, and nutrition. You will find programs. There is a website that was put together by a group of nutritionally oriented addiction recovery professionals. It's called Alliance for Addiction Solutions .org. It's a nonprofit, and it does have a directory on it. But my advice is to become very knowledgeable yourself from reading these books, because there is no program that is always good. There, you know, there's a lot of, you know, this is a pioneering field. And so I would make it very clear to the program that you're investigating that you want the amino acids individualized in your case. You don't want to have a formula. You want to make sure that there's a nutritionist on staff who can do that.
And is there any side effects that you have to look out for using
these? No, not particularly. You know, you can overdose on it, you know, and get too jittery on too much tyrosine, but that's easy to fix. You know, the jitters are gone in a few minutes, and the next time you take it, you lower the dose. It's actually a good sign if you've been taking, for example, tyrosine for a while, and you start getting jittery, then that means that your own brain is making its own stimulants and you don't need the extra tyrosine anymore.
So this isn't a program that's dependency. This is a program that's correcting.
Say that again?
This isn't a program that's creating a dependency on these supplements.
Oh, no. No, these are foods.
Uh-huh.
These are foods, and when you don't need the food anymore, you don't want it anymore. It doesn't make you feel progressively, you know, more positive the more you take it. No, there's a perfect amount for you, the way you feel a big improvement in mood and elimination of cravings. But if you take more, you'll just feel worse.
I've heard other people. people talk about using them intravenously, what would be the circumstance when that would be appropriate?
Well, that's a great way of putting it, because the intravenous is very elaborate, very expensive, and very awkward, and it isn't needed for most people. Where it's really wonderful is in the detox process from a very late stage, sick alcoholism or opiate addiction. Other than that, my experience is the orals are great and actually better. In the long haul, you can't keep doing IVs, and in my opinion, and I've helped develop them, they're just really necessary for early stage recovery, you know, the first week or so of recovery. And if the program happens to have them throughout the program, lovely. But the programs tend to also give the amino acids orally. Otherwise, they'd be having people in the IV every day for the whole 30 days they're there.
And those are available without a prescription, the amino acids?
Oh yes, in every health food store and online and every supermarket and drugstore.
And for someone who's been a recovering alcoholic and has had no relapses, let's say, for 12 years or so, but they're still dependent on the sugary...
and the caffeine.
Yes, those types of things for the cravings. It would be in their best interest to look into this.
Oh, it's wonderful. And the people around them are so glad, you know, that they do, when they do finally discover the aminos, because their temperament improves so much. They're happy in recovery instead of struggling and hanging on. They can sleep well. You know, some of the things that a lot of recovering people suffer with, there's a fairly high suicide rate it's quite high among alcoholics in recovery, because they can't bear to go back to the alcohol, but they can't bear the way, they can't sleep, they can't fight the depression or the anxiety or both. It's a real hell for an awful lot of people in recovery. And they hold on with great courage, but they've sort of buried their hopes for enjoying life. And they don't need to do that. So it's marvelous for people in recovery at any stage. The earlier the better, but at any stage, that brain is still waiting there in its, unhappy condition, waiting for some help. And the aminos are quick, simple, cheap, safe, temporary solutions. Temporary in the sense that they're not needed permanently.
Right.
Not that their benefits don't last.
Is there any information that you would recommend to someone who would like to present this nutritional information to a local addiction center to try to, broaden their what they offer locally?
Well, I would become very familiar with the material in these books that I'm talking about, and my website. But I'm not quite sure what you're talking about.
Oh, well, if there's a local addiction center that's not using nutritional therapy, what would...
Oh, no, I understand that you wanted to educate them and,
sure.
and inspire them, but with what? I mean, there aren't PowerPoints
right.
all set up for you to use, or
yeah.
what, if that's what you mean. But the Alliance for Addiction Solution website is the place to go, because it does have some a whole section on, for example, the research supporting this, which is a very important thing for these institutions to have. This isn't a harebrained scheme from, some former hippie. This is science-based.
Right. So it gives you the documentation of where this is all coming from?
Well, there's some good documentation in all of the books that I mentioned, but also on the Alliance website. And Dr. Blum, who was really the hero of this this treatment, this marvelous treatment, has his own websites. You know, people can Google Kenneth Blum, PhD, and see what he has on his own websites.
And your website again?
Well, I have several. Moodcure.com is one, and dietcure.com is the other. The name of my outpatient clinic here in Northern California, just across the bay from San Francisco, is the Nutritional Therapy Institute. And I do a lot of education, a lot of training of professionals in how to do this. And the information on that is on the Mood Cure practitioner resources pages and the moodcure.com website.
And can your books be ordered through that website, or would someone just go to Amazon.com?
Oh, they can go anywhere and order them, either place. They're easily found, Barnes & Noble, for that matter. These are books that have been selling very, very well now for a long time. I just revised the Diet Cure, and and I've been revising the Mood Cure as you know, new information comes out, or people contact me and say I didn't have a comma where it should have been, or whatever.
Well, Julie Ross, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us and being so generous with your information.
You're welcome, and thank you for getting this vital information out to your audience. Thank you for being a great source of information for your area.
Thank you.
Okay.
Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.